Thank you, James. Well, friends, it looks like we'll just move to some discussion in the room. I see a hand over there with Barbara, but I also have a question in the chat as well. So Barbara, why don't you go ahead and then I'll ask the question from the chat. And just so you know, after Barbara's question, you can keep messaging questions in the chat, or you're welcome to try to raise your hand either digitally or in the screen, and we'll try to catch it. So go ahead, Barbara.
I want to bring to everyone's attention the last paragraph in the second chapter. It's on page 180. And in the last paragraph, he really gives an excellent description of anti-racist and how to combat that. For instance, when he says anti-racist, he says we need to fuse desegregation with integration. And the important thing there is the verb, fuse. In the next sentence, he says support voluntary integration, champion resource equity. And these are all actions that we can take in our community, whether you're Black, white, green, purple, or blue. I personally have worked both in Chicago. I have lived and worked in the Black community. And I think I was just really impressed with that last paragraph. And I urge all of you to meditate on it, because it really is the answer to how we can move into a much more equitable situation. Thank you.
Are you in education, Barbara? Because that is spot
yes.
on.
Yes.
I can tell. Spot on, absolutely. And I think that I, as you heard me point out, the whole my love for language and being, you know, study of linguistics, it's those action words that you pointed out. Like, those are the things that we need to be, you know, have reverberating in our mind. You can read. Yeah, we can have conversations. You can watch documentaries. But it's that active thing that you're doing outside of just yourself that's going to have the largest impact. And so thank you for pointing that out to us there.
All right, the next question we got in the chat was from Teresa, and she says, regarding space segregation, how would a group like Word in Life begin to address being largely white?
Yeah, by respecting Black spaces. Last year was the first time in the history of Santa Barbara that I'm aware of that we actually had a Black space. It was called the Black History Month Culture House. It was on State Street in the former Youth Interactive area. It's right in the same block as the Impact Hub, now Kiva Cowork. And what we were able to do is we were able to secure that space for the month of February on the weekends to be able to provide programming. Last year, we had 5 weekends in February. It was weird. But we were able to have programming each week that was targeted towards the Black community. Now, having that be a Black space, everybody was welcome, but understanding that this is a Black space that you're walking into. And I think something about that is powerful, particularly in Santa Barbara, where there are no Black spaces. And so I was instrumental in helping, I was instrumental in helping get that established last year by knowing the people to pull together. Jordan Killebrew pulled him in. Simone Ruskamp pulled her in. There was a few other folks in town that we, you know, basically came together, had a conversation. A few weeks before we were able to, I mean, I think our first meeting was in late November. And by February, we had this place and a full month of programming. And so that's one thing that we were able to do, but there is still a push to be able to have something permanent and full time in Santa Barbara, right? And so knowing that that's an effort, finding ways to utilize those action verbs to support that work, and also understanding that there are spaces like that, particularly on our campus. And so at SBCC, you have the Umoja program, where they have a room that is specifically a Black space. Yes, everyone is welcome, but that is a space where Black students and faculty can go and know that they're home, right? You just heard me talk about it, but UCSB, the Office of Black Student Development, right? Having those spaces is of vital importance, and respecting those spaces is also important. So finding a way to be able to support, respect, and you know, also allow for those spaces to happen.
Thanks, James. Next question from Arlene is, how do you see classism impact the dialogue about reparations?
I mean, at the root of it, that is the conversation about reparations. It's classic, right? And you know, ultimately, the conversation about reparations is where we'll be. With like, that's where this boat is driving. Some folks will get there sooner than others, but what does reparations look like, and how does classism play? The reason, kind of tapping back into what I said about generational wealth, the fact that, okay, so reparations. Why do we need reparations? Well, if you look at the foundation of what has become known as America, right, and you look at how you know the U.S. economy is based on, you know, pretty much an agricultural economy, and that was based on a commodity known as cotton in the early years. And the only reason that that commodity was able to be so profitable is because of the free labor that it took to produce that, right? And so when you look at that whole notion of the free labor that created the economic base for our agrarian society's economy, and then you look at all the things that have been done to systematically disenfranchise that class of individual who were enslaved, once you realize it from that truth-based perspective, I don't think the conversation for reparations is very difficult, right? You get it. The notion of restitution is very American. A wrong was done, you're gonna pay for it. It's in our judicial system, right? So why are we the only ones who have ignored this process through, you know, ignored this process as a blueprint for racial reconciliation? Like, it seems willfully ignorant on our part to have not addressed this issue. Now, I think it was last week you heard there was a House hearing on H.R. 40, House Resolution 40, which is the bill to proposes starting a commission to study reparations. Let's at least start there. If you don't at least study and start the conversation, you're not gonna know what is possible. And so when you're looking at like, how does classism play into reparations? I mean, like, reparations is a class argument. The reason that we have generational wealth disparity is because of that original thing that started the economic wealth of our country. Now, I know there's a lot of smart people in the room that'll be like, well, there's also, you know, Black folks were given land, and there was a lot of things that happened between that and now. You know, and you can even look at the USDA, for some of the issues that were brought up as far as, you know, land grabs, sharecropping, like all of these things were systematically destructive to a class of people based on that very one metric of race, right? And so as, you know, as we get deeper into the conversation about reparations, I think a lot of the initial tension or rub that you're going to feel is class-based rub. It's the folks who have had power who were like, I don't see how those people can get any more power, and I'm going to keep what I have. And it's the notion of self-preservation. And, you know, there's something about that that's very familiar to me. Self-preservation, I get that. But that's not going to stop. That's not going to stop the movement.
Okay, I see Catherine and Michael Dean have a hand up.
Thanks, James. You've touched on this a little already, just in what you were talking about. What I was struck by most in the readings for this week was in chapter 12. And if people have their book handy, I'm looking at page 156, where Dr. Kendi writes, I saw poor Blacks as the product of racism and not capitalism, largely because I thought I knew racism, but knew I did not know capitalism. But it is impossible to know racism without understanding its intersection with capitalism. And he goes on to talk about being anti-racist also means, as he defines it, being anti-capitalistic too. And I was wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Yeah, no, I agree with that notion that they're inextricably tied together. I don't think we're gonna get rid of capitalism. But I think if we reimagine what that looks like and stop the self-preservation mentality, if we reimagine what that can mean for our country, you know, I think that is a potential path forward, potentially. And you know, that's a tough one, right? Because there's so much of capitalism that's based on that caste system, right? The reason that there's an increasing amount of the wealth in our country is owned by the 1%. That is the deepening economic divide, I think, is the problem, not necessarily capitalism, right? And you're asking my thoughts on that. And I guess I'll go ahead and let y'all peek into this. Coffee with a Black Guy came out of the conversation with reparations, right? In my mindset back in 2015, as I was cooking up this idea, I was like, man, reparations, that's just, it's not going to happen. America is not going to swallow that pill. We're just too racist. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to do anything about it. But what the system in America, the economic system in America has done is it's set up a blueprint for me to go get my reparation. And so in my mind, Coffee with a Black Guy is essentially monetizing the Black experience, right? This experience that I've had as a Black man in America and tapping into that culture. Now, and again, it's not just me. Like, did you all know that there's such a thing as Black Twitter, right? It's the same thing as regular Twitter, but we know about it, right? And so how does that happen? How does that happen? And so I think what this platform does, it allows you to kind of peek into that. Like, okay, so there's this, and you may have recognized it. When you see two Black people pass each other on the street, we do the nod. Like, you're not in on that. And I can see how that can feel kind of like, what, how come they didn't nod at me? Well, there's something about being Black that's very collective, but at the same time, we're not a model. And so when I take that idea and throw it on this economic model for Coffee with a Black Guy LLC, which I've started, is this is a process. And when we're going to have reparations, my notion of reparations is it's not just about the check. You have to have the check and the education. You can't have one without the other. Well, this is part of that educational process that's going to better prepare us to have the conversation about what's going to happen on the financial end. Thank you for that question. And I hope I answered it because I did kind of go off a little bit.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, James. Okay, I see a hand up from Jackie Reed.
Oh, hello. We have something in common, although I'm old enough to be your grandmother. I spent 40s and 50s. I lived outside of Baltimore in a town called Roxton. So I wonder if we shared the same space from time to time. Probably not because of the age difference. But that isn't what I was going to ask. I was going to ask if you had read Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast. I think you probably have. I was horrified in the beginning. I had no idea, and I don't think any of us did, that Hitler studied our so-called caste system very carefully before he decided on his program of extermination for the Jews, because he wanted to see how we managed it and how we got away with it in the eyes of the world. That sort of gave me a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach to think that we could have been the beginning, the nucleus of the Holocaust.
Oh, we were absolute enablers and continue to be, right? Just this week, a 95-year-old Nazi was deported from the U.S. for his actions there, from Tennessee. We know the reality that the U.S. provided safe harbor for many of these Nazis in Huntsville, Alabama, because they had the knowledge to help with our space program, right? And so, like the Holocaust is America's grandchild.
Hmm. Horrible. I recommend everybody read that book. It's full of eye-openers.
And a few, I think it was back just last month, there was a conversation. UCSB Arts and Lectures had Isabel Wilkerson in to talk about her book. And I facilitated a conversation after that, kind of unpacking it. But I mean, absolutely. Cast is a, you kind of heard me allude to it in some of the responses earlier about, classism. But, that will give you a good base for understanding. You can look at, so Cast and her other book, I can't recall the name of it right now, something about the sun. I can't recall the name, but basically Isabel Wilkerson points out that's exhibit. What is it? Okay.
Warmth of Other Suns.
That's it. Yes, thank you. Teamwork makes the dream work. So Isabel Wilkerson pointed out that that's exhibit A and exhibit B for the case for reparations, right? And so, you know, I definitely one to dive into.
Well, since we don't have any other questions just yet, I want to continue along the same theme of class and capitalism. I'm curious, James, your opinion on this, because sometimes I think when we dream of liberation, what we dream is capitalist equity. And can we get everybody, you know, together in this pursuit of wealth, or, you know, as I always draw a connection between Willie James Jennings, who says that whiteness is really the desire to possess, control, and master. And I think about that in terms of a connection with capitalism, which is the desire to produce, consume, and accumulate. And so I'm just wondering if there's a new imagination we could put on to talk about liberation and what it could look like in terms of our economic relations. Beyond, you know, it could be beyond between the capitalist economy, but I would just be curious if there's anything that you see in terms of this economic liberation that we need, not only for our society and for class and race, but for the planet as well.
Yeah, I mean, I love what Maura wrote in the chat, right? It's the idea of redistribution of power and resources. I think that's what it could look like. It's, you know, the conversation about relieving student loan debt, right? When we look at who carries the burden of the majority of that debt, that could be a racial and economic equalizer, right? In my community, my mom, who raised me, single mom, there was this notion about, you can get a loan to pay for your education, right? If you get a loan to pay for your car, your house, if you don't pay that loan, default on that loan, they can come take your car or house away. Once you get that education, can't nobody take that from you? So there is a mentality in the Black community that you're not going to pay back your student loan. You get that education and you just go, right? And what is that? That you know, is a detrimental mindset based on how the current student loan situation is set up and how that's tied to our credit rating, our credit score, and what that is allowing you to do in our society, and how that is a much bigger aspect of being able to be financially successful than anything else. Yet that's the one thing that they don't teach you in school. So yeah, so that those are kind of my thoughts on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm curious about it because, you know, it's almost as if, like, I agree with you, like what you said about capitalism. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. It's the water we're all swimming in. But I'm wondering if as we harbor this desire for liberation and want to enact it in the world, if we're able to put on a new imagination about like all the elements you brought together there in terms of creating more equity and you know, working with reparations, working with liberation from debt and things like that. I just, you know, I think it's vital that we attempt to enact this stuff and don't let it just be a means toward, you know, just maybe deepening the roots of capitalism further, because it's partly what got us into this situation, you know?
So, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm gonna look something up for real quick.
While you do that, is it okay to get another question, or you want to stay on the same theme?
So I kind of want to get on that, because it okay. There's something about that, like the superficiality of what's going on right now, right?
Right.
So if you take a look at, you know, if you watch TV and you look at commercials, you've paid attention to the, like, what has happened with commercials in 2020, and you see that, like, wait. So now there's a Black person in every commercial? Like, seriously? Like, where did this come from? It seems a bit inauthentic. And, you know, those of us who have been tuned to this stuff, it's just like, get out of here, like that. But that's how this is playing itself out, right? You look at, you know, the removal of Confederate statues and you know, leaders of cities taking knees, symbolic knees, but not doing anything to change the situation. Right. And so when we started this conversation, we started it rooted in action words, Yeah, taking a knee is an action, but it's a passive action, right? You know, so looking for ways to go beyond the superficial and really dig into it. And what I'm looking for is a Martin Luther King quote about not being tranquilized by the drug of grandiolism. And I think I found, because it really speaks to kind of where we are. There is no time to engage in luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of grandiolism, right? And so, you know, if you look at what's happened just in 2021, on January 5th, you know, there's this election. On January 6th, we wake up and we're like, oh, great, they won the election. Like, there's a change in who's in the Senate and who controls the Senate, this, that, and the other. But what did that lead to? Right. I think we were able to celebrate for maybe 2 hours before the whole tone changed. And so there's this notion of like, don't ever get too complacent saying like, oh, celebrating our victories, because that, you know, there's much more work to be done. And that tranquilizing drug of grandiolism is a real one.
Thank you. All right. Mary Becker has a question. Mary, if you want to unmute.
Hi, James.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us. It's a really great conversation. So I want to bring us back to Santa Barbara, and just want to say, I think it's incredibly important that you've taken the bold step, you know, to run for mayor and put yourself out there. I think it's terrific. So my question, you know, one of the things that several things have really caught me, but you're observing that people say, oh, Santa Barbara is mostly white. So, and I've said that to myself and thought it. So what is your program, or what are your thoughts on reaching out to the Latinx community here, who are also, mm-hmm. you know, marginalized in many ways and disenfranchised in some, so, well, you know, all this stuff. So what are you kind of, what's your program for that?
So I think there's already stuff happening in the community that doesn't get support, right? If we look at an organization called Freedom for Youth, right? There's an organization that has focused on the most disadvantaged youth in our community. And it's a nonprofit here in town. They like since the end of December, there's been 6 youth that are connected to Freedom to Youth program who've died, been killed in violence in our community, yet it's not part of the narrative. Why? This organization who's directly hit by that stuff, guess where their funding comes from? Nobody in Santa Barbara, no foundation locally. It comes from LA. Why is that? People in Santa Barbara, funders in Santa Barbara may not see the value in investing in at-risk youth who are coming out of juvenile detention, that are part of the Los Pierdes boys camp up in the hills, right? And so, you know, there's things that are happening in our community, culturally relevant programs that just aren't getting the support that they need to be effective. And so finding ways to bolster things like that, if it's no more than connecting them with potential donors who could see the value in investing in that. And the majority of those kids that are being helped, I think they're currently have a, helped in 2021, 77 youth, and they've addressed 77 youth. And what that means is the youth, their siblings, their parents, their grandparents, their aunts and uncles. So that 77 quickly becomes over 200 of people in our community who they're working with, the most at risk in our community. And so I think that there's ways to bridge that divide that we have in our community. And I think it's a cultural divide, but it's also an economic divide. An idea that I've been kind of cooking around, Mary, is looking at models that have happened in cities like Stockton and most recently Compton, to be the 25th city in the country to do this. What is this that you're talking about? A universal basic income program for the most at need. And so all of these programs, these universal basic income programs, the one that started in Stockton, the one that just started in Compton, they're public-private partnerships, right? So you find philanthropic people in the Stockton community who are gonna put money in a pot to be able to help the least in their community. And you're gonna tell me that there's a bigger economic divide in Stockton than Santa Barbara? You're gonna tell me that there's more philanthropic care and will in Stockton and Compton than Santa Barbara? Come on, we can do better. And it really is about just kind of starting that conversation. I mean, I believe in this room, there's people who could make the power of saying, you know what, that's an idea I like. Let's start this. And we start an endowment that funds that universal basic income. What does that universal basic income help with? It helps with housing costs, because we know how high housing is in this area, right? And so you could do that, or you could also do a back-end tax credit for the people who are going to help these folks. So if you're a landowner or a property owner, and you are housing an individual who's eligible for this universal basic income, you can do something with and to structure their rent, so you get a tax credit and they can still utilize that money for food. So, I mean, again, not a fully cooked idea, but these are things that I think we can put on the table to be part of the conversation that are very much in line with the culture and tone of our community. We are a very philanthropic community. What is it? Over 3,400 registered nonprofits in Santa Barbara. I think that's the number, or the last one I heard. I'm sure it's higher now, but that's the reality of our community.
I put the link to Freedom for Youth in the chat just in case anybody wants to check out their work and support. All right, Catherine and Michael Dean, I see your hand again.
Hi, I did read The Warmth of Other Suns, and there was a part, a character in that, the doctor who comes to California from Alabama, I think. And he, anyway, I wanted to know a little bit more about James' journey across the United States as a Black man.
Sure. I'll get into that. But what you brought up about the doctor coming from Alabama. So California has, and Governor Newsom just signed a bill that allows for this task force to study reparations to happen here in California. It's a 9-person task force. 2 members of that task force have already been appointed. And there's the Speaker of the Assembly has 2 appointments, and the governor has 5 appointments, right? And so they're supposed to get together to talk about what would reparations look like in California. Well, we know California founded in 1850, didn't really have slaves to work the land. So where do we connect to this? California was allowed to. So there was a lot of folks that made that migration from the South to California, a lot of Black folks. A lot of Black folks who I meet in this area, you're like, where's your family from? Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, down South, Louisiana, like that kind of situation. And their families came up here to flee the South. So what California did allow is it allowed for the capture of these migrated enslaved individuals and the capture and return to the South. And so what financially does that look like for our state, right? What does that financially look like? And that at least gets the ball rolling and the conversation happening. Now you were asking about my journeys across the country and how that, the migration, how that is formed. I mean, it's, again, we have a beautiful and vast country. Where we're at in Santa Barbara is a bubble. Anybody who's grown up in Santa Barbara who leaves, they don't see it until they leave. There's a young woman in town named Jules Bolden, Santa Barbara native, African-American woman, grew up here, decided to go to Howard University. Hearing that sister's story about the culture shock going from Santa Barbara to Howard and then back is wow. I hope, and she's been on several conversations before, but I've been trying to encourage her to let her story shine a little bit more, because it's I mean, that is the reality. And what that means is, like, that you heard me earlier talking about the richness of Black culture, right? You know, okay, well, you know, the history, well, there's a richness of Black culture, but how is it that when we're studying Black people in history, all we learn about is slavery, right? And that's where we start. Well, there's a saying about, okay, so, and also looking at the fact that kind of, you know, Black music has always kind of evolved into pop music, and there was this, you know, kickback to hip hop music, but now hip hop is pop music. Like, that is the world's pop music. And so I think it's largely steeped in the notion of like I said, our worldview. What is it? What's your view on the world? How do you view things? And the fact that we've got this mentality of our love for Black culture, yet our hate for Black people, right? The statement goes, you want our rhythm, but don't want our blues, right? If you look at the fact that, you know, there's a song, you know, and there's this, okay, so everybody loves Elvis, rock and roll, understanding where he got that from. And that's just one of many examples. An example I like to use is also the light bulb. If we were still using the light bulb that Thomas Edison created, we'd still be in the dark, right? It took a Black man, Lewis Latimer, to be able to perfect the filament that conjoined with what Thomas Edison did to make what we have today. But we're told Thomas Edison created the light bulb. We're not told the whole arc of that story. And so, you know, and I don't know if that gets on the whole travel across the country. I probably got off on that a bit. But, you know, I think informing folks about the whole arc of that story. And I think, you know, that I guess I'll tie it back into knowing the whole arc of our American story. Like, you know, people that I've met from Santa Barbara want to boast about their international travel, but haven't traveled domestically. And so how does that inform your worldview? I absolutely think that international travel is important, and I've missed it over the past year. But what is more important is an understanding of our own selves, right? And if you go over and you see other countries, they have an understanding of our problems, of our challenges, of our history, but we aren't steeped into that. And so, you know, when you look at what the reality of that has meant for America, what the reality of my migratory patterns, the reality of access to wealth distribution, access to property, all of that stuff is kind of rooted back in that aspect of racialized class. Okay, teamwork, it makes the dream work. Someone's asking a question about who will be on my leadership team. I question my leadership team for what?
Hi there, it's Maura here.
Hello.
Thank you so much. I think I might have met you through a Pacifica Zoom call with Diane way back when, yeah. New Year's Eve or something like that. Anyhow, yeah. Just curious, like the teamwork and the dream work, that's really the power of community. And I'm wondering if you're already sort of dreaming into who you want to be on your team with your potential mayorship of Santa Barbara.
The reality of it is the mayor doesn't get a team. Yeah, it's a strong city administrator governance, right? And so the mayor is one of seven votes, and the team members are the city council members, right? The current situation doesn't seem to have that mentality of the city council members being team members. Now, team members aren't all doing the same thing. Team members don't all score the victory, but it takes that team to win the game. And when you're looking at that team being members who are on the city council, it makes sense to me, since we've gone to district elections and having the mayor being the only at large elected position, is that the mayor as a visionary leader should take the input from the various representatives from the district, and that makes up the priorities, right? And so in talking with various council members, understanding their, finding out about what their priorities are within their own district, I think is key. Some of those things, one of those things is looking at the Lacumbre Plaza, right? And seeing how, okay, well, things are gonna be happening with that. There is already some energy around that area that's been happening, but what does that look like? And how do we work through a master plan? And so my view is, okay, what do we want the end goal to be? We start there and plot it backwards. Like, okay, so each city council member, you give me your top three priorities, great. Now on your top priority, your homework assignment is to go and plot that thing out. This is the end goal that we want. How do we get there? What are we gonna need to do in order to get there? And how can we as a team help achieve that goal? If you do that for every member who's representing a district, it seems to me like that's a winning strategy.
Thank you, James.
And I hope that didn't dive into too much of a civics lesson, because I tend to do that sometimes. I apologize.
No, not at all. I heard that there's another hand up. I haven't seen it in the chat, but if you want to unmute, go ahead.
Hi. Again, this is the first time I've heard you speak, James, and it's just wonderful to think that that kind of energy can be coming into Santa Barbara. I work with the criminal justice system in Santa Barbara, at both mainly at the county level, and trying to work with policies and changes. And I wondered what your thoughts are, your recommendations, what you would say about the processes going on now, what we need to do and work for, both short-term and long-term.
And you're talking about at the county level?
Yeah, the criminal justice system. Yeah.
I don't want this to be misconstrued as beating up on any in particular person, but the whole concept of the sheriff and how that sheriff is independently elected and really doesn't have to answer to the Board of Supervisors, I'm not too comfortable with that. I know that when compared to municipal police departments, sheriffs are the direct descendants of slave patrol, right? And so when you look at the proliferation of policing in America, you can tie the whole structure of a sheriff and having deputies back down to the slave. There's a overwhelming mindset amongst law enforcement that they don't like to be told what to do. Don't tell us what to do. I've seen it at the legislative level. They're lobbying. Anytime there's a bill that would require more accountability or transparency, that you can see the Sheriff's Association, the Deputy Sheriff's Association, like they're fighting these things, right? And so that tells me that they don't want to be told what to do. I've essentially heard those words directly from Bill Brown's mouth, our sheriff, who was the former president of the statewide Sheriff's Association. And so I think divorcing that mindset would be helpful. You need, like, you're elected by the people to protect the people. So why wouldn't you listen to the people? Right. You know, that's my mindset. But so Sheriff Brown's reluctance to have a civilian review process is detrimental to our county. Haven't been impressed with how he deals with opposition. So the past two times that he was challenged by people, by, you know, folks that work under him, what happened to those individuals after they ran against him? That's worth a community question. Folks were reassigned. So that kind of mentality doesn't exude a whole lot of confidence in me that we're dealing with something that's above board. Now, I get it. I know a lot of people are, you know, the, you know, anti investing in prisons, and he built the new jail up in North County, and that's his main project. I agree with that project. I'm not a big fan of having more prisons and jails, but I think that when we do have them, they should be, you know, humane. And that means sometimes we need to invest in that kind of infrastructure, because it's not like we don't need jails and prisons. We need them. We just don't need so many of them, and we don't need them to be part of the capitalistic model, right? We don't need them to be driven by profit, the more beds they have. And so that, you know, I think, you know, I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, I think that more accountability is a good thing. More transparency is a good thing. And anything we can do as a community to beat that drum and help others who are doing that work to support them to beat that drum, I think would be key.
I do have a question. There's a group that came in, and there's been some public meetings, including one of the last ones on the sheriff. And it's a performance evaluation from the outside of each of the criminal justice departments, called the KPMG. I don't know if you've read the recommendations, and I was so impressed that there's some real strong recommendations for changes that if we got behind as a community, it seemed like we could do an additional thing to oversight, but really work within the system to radically change what's going on. And I was wondering if you were aware of that and what you thought about it. We were impressed.
Yes, I mean, not specifically, but I think that what should be mentioned is the good things that are happening here. I mean, the fact that our county sheriff's department has been utilizing the model with mental health professionals more, and, you know, it took a tragedy to get there, right? It took the Elliot Rogers situation, knowing that they knocked on the doors, law enforcement, and were ill-equipped to deal with that situation until after it happened, right? And so when you see that you know, that there was an encounter with law enforcement prior to that, and no one who carried a badge and a gun and a taser was equipped to help assess that and prevent that, that's a problem. And that's an area of opportunity. And I think that the Sheriff's Department has moved in that direction. And I think we need to applaud that and continue to support that. And so it's not all about just pointing fingers and saying, you should be doing this. It's like, when they're doing this, that's good. Good job. Now keep doing your job well. And so I local governments love to pay consultants to write reports, right? And that's good. That helps the economy. But if you write these reports and put them on a shelf and don't act on them, what are you doing? And so, not just in law enforcement, but business as well. I mean, we've had a review of our business permitting process, and there have been recommendations that have been made, but have we moved on those recommendations, right? And so, I mean, if we're gonna seek the expertise of consultants, I think it would be a better use of our money if we actually acted on what they recommended. Not everything, but if we've invested the money for them to tell us stuff, don't just take the stuff they told us and set it in a binder up on the shelf. Let's do something.
Thank you.
And so one last thing, what about cash bail and the possibility of what they're doing in LA compared to Santa Barbara? I mean, we could do it. The district attorney could actually say, we're not having that anymore. And we don't seem to be having a lot of action to make that happen.
Well, why didn't you vote for the proposition? It was on the ballot in November, right? Why was that not a bigger element of marketing and outreach to on about this election? We could do it
as a county.
Had a vote for it.
We
could have responded to COVID better as a county, but it's not a county issue. It's a national issue. Right. And so the cash bail issue, that's a local issue. But if somebody from Santa Barbara is in Ventura County and commits a crime or is involved in some sort of a crime, somehow gets caught up in things, we're still dealing with a cash bail system. Like, what are we doing? That's the equivalent of supporting sundown towns. And we have those still in California, too. There's one not too far from us, a sundown town. What's that up? I'll let you Google it. But there's something called the Los Angeles County's Lost Hills Division of the Sheriff's Department. Lost Hills Division. Wait, I've heard that before. Well, about a year ago, there was a problem because the deputies from the Lost Hills Division were the ones who were sharing gruesome photos of the Kobe Bryant chopper crash. They were the ones who were involved in the most recent situation that's causing an NAACP lawsuit against Target and the Sheriff's Department back in January, where Sheriff's Departments were assaulting African-Americans who they assumed were still. There's I've been told specifically from members of the NAACP regionally, don't drive through Westlake at night. It's a sundown town.
Wow.
Thanks, James. We've got another question from Diana. If you want to unmute.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. James, this is more national, but I'm concerned with this series is wonderful, and I'm glad to have heard you. But I'm hearing a lot of the southern states are going to enact more voter suppression laws. Is there anything we can do, anything we need to know at this point to help stop that process? Otherwise, the Republicans are going to get in control again.
I mean, I'm a fan that I believe in the motto that all politics is local, right? And so I guess the keeping the ear to the ground to make sure there aren't moves like that happening within the state of California and where you can support what's going on in other states, right? And I say where you can, because at the end of the day, we need to be focused on what's happening in our community. What we can change is here. We can't change things going on outside of our community. And so, tap into that. Stay aware of what's going on with voter suppression. If there's an opportunity to plug in and help with any local efforts that are happening in other states or cities, I'm thinking about in Georgia, they may be doing phone banking and getting folks out on, like, there's things like that you can plug into. There's donating to, I don't remember the name, but that organization that Stacey Abrams is a part of, that's been doing that grassroots work, supporting that stuff. But I think, you're good to stay vigilant, keep an ear about those things and make sure that if in any way possible that we're supporting efforts to fight those things back, because that's like that's incremental needle moving. Like in politics, something Hannah Beth was sharing with me is that, like, basically the role of politics is to help incrementally move the needle. There's not gonna be big drastic change because that's not how the system is set up. It's not set up for big drastic change. It's set up for incremental movement. And so making sure that as we're progressing towards a better community, that we don't allow the slide back to happen. I'm going to date myself and the Paula Abdul song, Two Steps Forward and One Step Back, right? Like, we don't want that. We want to continue forward steps. And so, you know, keeping an eye on that and then making sure that we stay tapped into that. There's an organization in town that does a good job at that, SPARC. I don't know what it stands for, but they've been doing a lot of work in other states just off that basic thing that there's local folks who want to be useful and there's they're helpful in plugging into specific states that can be useful.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Hey, friends. Well, we are winding down this morning. We've got a couple of minutes left. If there's one final question before we move to close, somebody.
The time always flies in these conversations for me.
I know. Okay, I see Cindy's hand up. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi, Mr. Joyce. I have really, really enjoyed this with the community in Santa Barbara. I live in Oxnard. Okay. I am wondering, as someone with Irish background, where you got your name?
Yeah, I got it from my dad and my granddad. I'm the third.
Really?
And, you know, finding out a little bit more about my dad's side of the family, you know, that side were oystermen on the Chesapeake Bay. And so the idea that they actually knew James Joyce or anything about the literary connection, probably not. And I appreciate that question because I am doing that family research now. And what that family research has revealed is that my grandfather, my great-grandfather, so my dad's grandfather was a sharecropper on a property that is now in historic preservation on the Maryland Eastern Shore. It's called Davidsonville, Maryland. It's a 1600 acre farm that is in historic preservation. Well, hold on. My great grandfather used to be a sharecropper on that property. Well, I know what sharecroppers were. It's just another name for enslavement. So I'm working with a research team back in the University of Maryland to fill out that thing. And it's so difficult because there's not good records,
right?
But working to say, okay, so I know that my great-grandfather was a sharecropper on this property that's now in historic preservation and only allows members of the family that own that property to develop on those 1600 acres. However, if my grandfather was a sharecropper on there, and I can trace it back to the fact that my ancestors were enslaved on that property, a property that is in historic preservation, why? Because George Washington spent several weeks on that property. So there's a strong possibility that my ancestors may have served George Washington, right? That's an interesting story to know. That's an interesting story to be able to tell. It's not a pleasant story. It's beyond him chopping down the cherry tree. It's the real story about George Washington. But I think that that is where we need to go. We need to go to that truth base, rooted into that stuff. And so, you know, as we, you know, it may have just been a question about my last name, but that is very indicative of kind of like the American connection. As I talk about reparations being a dual parallel track of education and financial, I think that that education aspect is also part of that self-identity. When you say that you're Irish, I could say, my family came from oystermen on the Eastern Shore at least two generations ago. But beyond that, I can't anchor back to, you know, and I don't trust the whole, that all those ancestry.coms and stuff, that's it's commercial. But, you know, tracing back to a land or a country of origin for the family, like that, there's something that's very soul filling about knowing that about yourself.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I used to live on D Street when I was down in Oxnard.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
All right. Well, thanks again, James. And Anna, would you like to close our time this morning?
Yes. Can you hear me? Am I mute? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, James. Really important presentation. Maya Angelou said, I loved her. So her, she, I quote from her, if you must look back, do so with forgiveness. If you must look forward, do so with hope. But the best thing is to be present right now and be grateful. And what I'm really grateful for is you, James, because I like what you're doing right now. I like that you started conversations years ago. We're just beginning to have these conversations. You started it. You were raising consciousness in Santa Barbara a long time ago. It's very important what you're doing right now. So I'm really grateful for you. Blessings as you move forward. You've got a lot of supporters from today. So we will see everybody next week. Looking forward to next week. Our speaker will be the Reverend Chris Brown, pastor of Bethania Lutheran Church in Solvang. And the topic will be gender and sexuality. Interesting topic. Anyway, thanks again, James, and goodbye to everybody.
Thank you for committing to doing this work. Great stuff.
All right, y'all.
Thank you.
Thanks again, James. We'll see you all next week.